Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where you are. We have a rare treat today. Actually, Graham Norton's publicist told me that I should do this event because it would be such a treat for me, let alone you. So anyway, we are meeting today Graham Norton, who many of you probably know from his incredibly successful and delightful career on radio and BBC television and whatever else he does. And I cheated. And watched part of an interview that he did earlier. So I already know, unless there were lies told during that interview, that sort of midlife, he decided that maybe he could actually complete an entire book. And presto, he's turned into the successful author of, this is his fourth novel, the first being Holding, then A Keeper, then Homestretch. And additionally, he's done memoirs called Saw Me and the Life and Loves of a He-Devil, which is the title so intriguing. I would like to know, do you really see yourself as a he-devil?
Well, it was just a title. It was something to call it. And apparently, titles aren't copyrighted. So I just stole Faye Weldon's book title, and I did meet her afterwards and she forgave me. So it was all good.
No, you're absolutely right. They are not copyrightable, but it can lead to enormous confusion. And occasionally, if you remember Paula Hawkins, you know, The Girl on the Train or whatever, somebody wrote a book entitled it The Girl on the Train, and it accidentally turned into a bestseller because people clicked on
it. Clever.
It really was.
I remember in London at one stage, there was a musical version of the show Happy Days, you know, the TV show Happy Days. But there was also a production of Samuel Beckett's Happy Days, you know, with the woman buried up into her waist in sand. And they were running at the same time. And people would, like that, confuse them when booking online. And there were some very confused theatergoers.
Well, I know. And, you know, when it's so easy to click, it's really awfully easy to click on the wrong link. But anyway, we are here to talk about Graham's fourth novel called Forever Home. And for those of you who might be confused, it came out in the UK in, I believe, July. Is that right?
This year, it came out in paperback in July. It came out before Christmas in hardback. And now it's here in hardback.
Gotcha. All right. And I think the actual publication date is not till September 5th, although I won't swear to it, but we're having a preview. That's what I think.
Yeah. Anyhow,
this is our book that we're going to be discussing. And I think it has some really interesting storylines and elements, but to get to that, since I have listened to Graham discuss his writing process and how he came to be a novelist, I think it might be fun to lead into this by talking about that. So as I understand it, you know, after various projects that never fully came to fruition, you were able to write a whole novel. And the way that you did it was to envision a situation. And from that, then there were characters, and then from that came plot. Is that roughly how you conceive a book?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the first book I was writing, Holding, you know, as you said, I didn't know if I could write a book. Mm-hmm. I'd always wanted to. And finally, as I kind of turned 50, I felt, oh, I can sit at a desk for long enough to write a book. I'm not such a flibbertigibbet and gadding about quite as much. So I had an idea in my head. It was based on a story that my mother told me about a house. And it was David Nichols. Do you know the author David Nichols, who wrote One Day and lots of other things, Sweet Sorrow? And I met him at an event for one of those memoirs. And I'm saying, I'm going to write a novel. And he was the one who said to me, look, give yourself structure. You know, it seems really uncreative and really dull, but put scaffolding in place. Plot it out, know where you're going. And then on the days when it's really hard work, and it is like pushing a boulder up a hill, at least you know where you're going. And you can take down the scaffolding if you don't like it, you know, but start with that. And it was very good advice. So with that first book, another writer might have made a sort of very bleak, dark romance. I turned into a murder mystery. So, you know, a body is found very quickly. Halfway through, a second body is found. By the end, the detective's in danger, and then it's all resolved. So I knew what I was doing. But what I found was that the stuff I was enjoying writing the most was kind of the backstory for all the characters and the emotional scenes and those sort of conflicts. And that kind of whodunit element interested me less. So each book has been slightly different. And I think this one, Forever Home, it is an, I can't pretend, it is an odd book. You know, I think the other books have had their eccentricities, but they've been more kind of tonally consistent. This one is, you know, it has quite bleak, dark things in it. It has sort of almost sort of farcical elements. So by the end of it, the way I make sense of it is I describe it as a dark romp. That's my take on this book.
So is it unnerving, you know, to even think that none of the characters in this book are really alive until you start writing them? And then they probably spend so much time in your head that you know, you're never alone while dining.
Well, that is so true. And I can't remember who I was talking to, and they were talking about that moment when you begin a book and how exciting that is, that suddenly a world that did not exist begins to exist. And certainly what I find with the characters in this book, it begins with a woman called Carol. And we always assume when we see older people in relationships that they're stable relationships, they're very settled. But of course, that's not the world we live in anymore. You know, people are often on their second or third relationship. And so she's been with Declan for maybe 5 years when he begins to get ill. And she turns out she's got no real security at all. She's got no claim on her home. She's not got claim on anything. And in the beginning of the book, her boyfriend's adult children, they are really kind of the baddies of the book. And I don't know, but I found writing a novel, because you spend so much time with these characters, people can't stay baddies. They can't stay, you know, flatline baddies. You end up, you know, in their mind for that long that you start to find, you know, some sort of empathy, or you try to find out, well, hang on, how did you end up in this situation? How did you end up doing this? What made you think this was an okay way to behave? And so characters kind of, and I maybe it's a flaw, a bad thing, but I do end up sort of liking, or at least having sympathy for all the characters in the book.
Well, it might be, I mean, maybe just my own experience, but my own experience is that Irish authors, Irish people in general, are more forgiving than other cultures. And also humor is like a key part of the way people move on. And so I thought, when I wrote up this book for our own customers, I said that, you know, that just whatever was going on, that there's this sort of Irish sensibility of humor and forgiveness, as you say. So nobody's truly black and white. Now, am I just stereotyping the Irish here, or am I onto something?
I think you are onto something about the humor. I think the fact that Irish people will often find a way to find things funny, it is very healing. It does help you move on. Whereas, you know, I think if you land on just grief or just anger, you get a bit stuck. Whereas I totally agree with you. I hadn't thought about it before, but humor is a very good way to help kind of ease you over the bumps in the road, I would say.
Well, yeah, no, I think so. Although occasionally there's a crime novel, which is like Stuart McBride, you can hardly go darker. You know, but generally, so other, you know, I've had the Zoom is a wonderful thing, because it does allow us to visit with authors that we wouldn't normally see at the store. So Catherine Ryan Howard, for example, John Connolly during COVID, whatever, we've had a lot of conversations with authors, you know, overseas. Actually, one of the things I thought was sort of amusing, I'm just going to sidebar here, but anybody who watches our programs know that digression is what I do.
I like it.
The publisher here is called Harpavia, and they are dedicated to Publishing International Voices. Now, this is the month of women translators, honoring women and women who've written and women who translate. So women authors, books and translation. And so we just assume that when they talk about International Voices, it's not going to be English. And I find this sort of fun that they have classified you under Harper Vita as an international voice, because you didn't actually write it in any kind of, you know, thick brogue or something. Or maybe somebody translated it. Maybe
maybe they have. They make me do the audiobook, which I don't enjoy. Well, because it's so hard. I wish they would just employ a proper actor, because actually Americans will probably think the audiobook's okay. So I'll throw that out there. But anybody Irish listening to these audiobooks, the accents are all over the place, because if ever, you know, because you can't just do one accent, because then everyone sounds the same. So you've got to find different voices and different accents for the different characters. So members of the same family, if you're Irish, you can tell they come from all different parts of the island. I think audio-wise, the books work best internationally and not at home.
That's really fun. I love it. So my spiritual home is actually Ashford Castle, where if I could actually live there, I would. But and I like the Great Atlantic Way and Galway. We've actually not only driven all around Ireland, which was a traumatic experience.
Yes.
My husband was incredibly brave. At one point, I have to tell you, we were going somewhere. It might have been sort of like suburban Galway or something. Maybe we were driving along an Irish road and it keeps getting rockier and rockier, you know, but we think it's just perfectly normal. And all of a sudden we ran into giant bulldozers and roving equipment and a sign that said road under construction, and Robin had to reverse. Because we couldn't tell the difference. I know, it was wonderful.
Yeah. I just talked to some friends and they're going to Ireland and they were going on a driving holiday. And I was sort of trying to explain to them, you know, it's not quite as scary as the Amalfi Coast in Italy, but it's pretty close. You know, a lot of those roads don't have lanes. They're just kind of a single lane road. And on a map, you can't tell. It looks like it's going to be a decent road. And oh, no.
Well, this is very true. You will find out if you rent a car in Ireland at the airport that you can't get. You have to buy their insurance, because none of the American car, you know, travel, including American Express, will cover you, because no, it's really true. The accident rate. The reason I know that is that my husband, the same one that had reversed down the road under construction, took that as an insult and refused to buy the insurance. So I was like this, you know, the whole time going, don't run into anything. As I reached out and I could touch a wall that was slightly beyond my whatever. But we've also sailed all around Ireland, going from the Sillies and then up north and around. I've been to the Giant's Causeway now probably 5 times. And therefore I know that it's pretty close to go across the Irish Sea to Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely.
A subject that just came up when I was talking to somebody, maybe it was Catherine. Anyway, I just have a little trouble with the idea that this is an international voice, but there we are. So back to the writing process. My experience, Graham, is that successful novelists are always going, what if? And where some of us are just plowing along and, you know, we hear something or we see something and all, we don't give it a whole lot of thought. Novelists become electrified and they go, what if? And is that what happens to you? I mean, is the situation that you're creating a sort of a like a what if moment from something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the last book, Homestretch, that was, you know, you hear, going back to traffic, actually, you every summer when I'm back in Ireland, you always hear about these terrible road accidents. And it's young people. And it's, you know, there's too many people in the car, or they're overconfident, or sometimes there's drink taken or whatever, but terrible crashes and young people lose their lives. But sometimes, and I don't know why this happens, often the driver survives. And I just thought, what happens in a little town like that. If you are the driver of a car and you have caused an accident which killed your friends, killed the children of your parents' friends, everyone knows who you are. It's just, that seems to me a life blighted before it's even begun. You know, how does someone go on with their life? So that was the beginning of Home Stretch. This one was going back to that idea of an older relationship that isn't, that is quite new. Because someone, I was speaking to someone, an older woman, and she was moving back to be closer to her family. And so she was packing up her house. And she just said, of course, this is the second house I've packed up this year or something. And, you know, that got on my head. What would be the other house she packed up? And then I thought, well, what if she had a boyfriend? What if she had a boyfriend who either died or had to go into a home? And so she had to pack up his house. And that sort of got me thinking about that idea of older relationships where actually you're still really boyfriends and girlfriends in that kind of almost teenage way. And that's how I ended up with Carol and the idea of her boyfriend. It's so weird. A partner, let's go with partner, Declan, who's a bit older than her. And he gets a sort of form of dementia and he gets put into a home. And I just wondered, what happens to that woman? How does she, you know, create her life? And then that was all fine. And I was writing the book and da, da, da. And then her mother came into the story. Carol's mother is Moira. And she is a sort of larger than life matriarch. And she's funny. I find her very funny. And so she suddenly brought all this humor into the book. And she's one of those... I like to think Irish, but maybe it's an international, going back to international, maybe it's an international thing of mothers who show their love by doing rather than saying. So she's a very active woman. You know, she feels like if there's a problem, you know, I will solve it. I, Moira, will solve this problem. And of course, often she makes things much worse, which happens in the book. She, you know, there are so many moments where someone could just, you know, blow a whistle and go, time out, stop, let's stop this madness, let's just get out of this. Because there's a kind of a twist in the book where you discover there's been something very dark happened in the past with Declan's family. But it was kind of Moira that changed the tone of the book and brought in kind of comedy elements.
Along with the dark elements, right. I read this in part as a cautionary tale, and I'm going to go back to Megan Abbott. You may not know her work. She's a multi-award winning American author, and we did an event for her in June. And her book asked or postulates two things, but asks two questions, one of which is, do we really know the person that we're married to or our partner?
Yeah.
And the other is, What do children owe their parents, and what do parents, you know, owe their children? But in other words, what do you owe to family? And if you're a child and your parents have difficulties or history or so forth, which in this book certainly is the case, what do you owe them as versus your own life? And I thought about both those questions reading this. And then the reason I say I think it's a cautionary tale, in another life, I was a lawyer, and we often found that people, women in particular, hadn't really taken care of themselves. And so when things went south, particularly in a marriage, and property has to be, you know, divided, because I don't know how it is in Ireland, but here we have community property very often where, you know, regardless of the wishes of the parties divorcing, everything gets halved, and which often means that neither party can keep like the family home or something, because neither one is going to have enough assets to buy out the other. So it all gets sold. And anyway, and I thought about, you know, your gal Carol here, who, you know, has been living with Declan, but she clearly has not considered what that means. You know, she's moved into his house and so forth, and she hasn't thought about what happens if something happens. And he's a lot older too, so it should have occurred to her. And that's why she's in a position to have Declan's children, you know, throw her out. Yeah. And, you know, I always want to say to people, and I used to say to it when I, you know, you need it seems it's not romantic, but you really need to think about, you know, and not like a prenuptial thing, but you do need to think about ownership and how you're going to deal with that. You know, a fabric of a marriage can be a very long thing or a very short thing.
It's also, I think, interesting because I think it reflects on Declan, who's a character we never really know in the book.
Well, we can't.
Because of memory, because he's actually the only one who knows exactly what happened.
Right.
And he can't tell us because his memory's gone. And so Carol discovers things about Declan as the book goes on and doesn't really know which version of Declan is true. The one that she experienced, or did she not, were her experiences true, or she kind of, did she put them through some sort of filter of romance? Because I suspect if she had tried to talk to Declan about, oh, I want some stability here, I want some rights, I need, you know, can we do a lease or something, da, 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 I'm pretty sure he would have said no. And I think she knew that he was not a man to be challenged. He was a man you went along with, I would say. That's probably why she didn't do any of that. Because I do think, you know, there's a thread in the book of him being either benignly controlling or sort of, you know, in a very detrimental sense to other people, controlling.
I love the way you said that, because the truth is you're the only person who actually knows what has gone on with Declan. You know, I mean, an author is the god in the book, right? So there we are. I mean, Declan, you know, is in his way. He's an unreliable, or he's not even a narrator, but he certainly would be unreliable. And that's something novelists have used to great effect over time. And, you know, whether it's somebody waking up in a coma and or suffering from amnesia for one reason or another. And it's interesting, it can go into all kinds of forms. I mean, there's a really hilarious cozy spy story that I love by Allie Carter. I don't know if you know her as an actress, but you know, she is a character suffering from amnesia, and we don't know if it's from injury, and we don't know whatever, we don't. And that's part of the whole thrust of the story, right? As events move along, you have to ask, is she going to remember who she is, or are we going to learn who she is from somebody else, or is she never going to know who she is and she's going to have a whole new life? So I sort of thought, you know, that people change, and especially under trauma. And, you know, I wondered if both Declans could kind of be true.
Yes, I agree with you. I think both Declans can be true. And also, don't you find, I find narrators, they can only provide the information they've been given. And they can, and they are seeing it through their own eyes. Do you know the book Fingersmith?
No, I know what it is, but I've not read it.
Oh, it's so good. And it is the best twist I've ever read. And it's because someone is telling the story, and then halfway through, you realize they have no idea what they were talking about. they got it very, very wrong. And it's thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling. But I think there's a lot of that in this book, where people are making sense of the information they have. Like, there's a daughter, Sally, who sees Declan and Carol's relationship in one way. And then as she gets older, she begins to understand that actually people, you know, they hadn't set out to hurt her. Because, you know, Carol was her teacher, and she idolized her teacher, Carol. And then in her head, her father kind of stole her from her, in that kind of teenage crush way. And I think of all the characters in the book, I think Sally's the one who kind of has the best kind of outcome in a way, because she has, I suppose she has kind of, she's had the bleakest life up until the start of the book. And then things start to happen for her.
So we've dealt with situation and characters, and, you know, they come to populate the situation. But unless you're just going to have like a drawing room comedy, or, you know, I can't work out what a literary thriller is. I'm often puzzled when people describe. I think what it means is that not enough happens in the story to make it a real thriller.
Yeah, but there's a lot of weather.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'm a big fan of elegant prose. I mean, you know, the workable prose is okay, but I love beautiful writing. But all of that aside, it's not enough to engage me if there's not really a story. Oh, and the story has to move.
I'm so agree with you. I will read a book and I can enjoy the sentences, I can enjoy the descriptions, but if I don't know why I'm reading the book, then I do find that frustrating. I want to know, why am I bothering to turn this page? And so I'm very aware of that when I write these books. I'm very aware of having, you know, enough plot to keep a reader going. Sometimes too much plot, but that's certainly very much at the forefront of my mind.
You do as you say. You want to keep the reader interested enough to keep pursuing the story. We have these conversations because, you know, we do like a zillion events, and so oftentimes we have long conversations, because here's the real truth: if you're discussing a crime novel and people have driven like 50 miles to come to the event, you have to really talk for an hour, and you only get like 10 minutes to discuss the book, or you've totally ruined the plot. So yeah. Digression is the name of the whole thing. And one of the things we talk about often is why people like some books and not others. And I generally say to them that life is too short to read a bad book, and hard as it is for most people to start a book and not finish it, because, you know, whatever reason, that you really need to put it aside and try something else. And a lot of the reason people stop reading is because they are not turning the pages. They don't really get propelled along by the author.
Do you know, often, I sort of disagree with you. Often I'll be reading a book and I'm not enjoying it. And like that, I'm thinking, oh, life's too short, I should put this down, da, 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 da. And then you'll just come to a paragraph or a phrase or a situation, and I'll be just, oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad I read that. Because I'm in my head, there is an example of this happened to me just last week. I was reading something and I suddenly came to this bit, but now, of course, it's gone. I can't remember what the hell it was. But it was just a little idea. And of course, you know, you tell yourself, I'll remember that. Here I am, days later. But I remember it made the whole book worthwhile. It was just that little paragraph. And yeah, I loved it.
Well, I suppose that, you know, reading for a living is, well, not for a living, because actually ours is a not-for-profit bookstore, but reading, you know, in the quantity. Do you know that recently I've been getting statistics from, I think it's Goodreads, which we won't go into Goodreads because it's very controversial and I don't ever go there. But anyway, they email me as though they thought I really didn't want to go there. And one of the things they have said for the last 3 or 4 weeks is, there are 288 new adult fiction hardcovers publishing this week. Seriously. So I sort of did the math for August, and I conclude that there are, and then there were like 1,100 nonfiction books or something. Anyway, the publishing world is getting larger and larger. I mean, there are just more and more books. So we've had to start making decisions about our focus. You know, we can't cover that multitude of books. So what is it that we want to guide our readers towards, you know, is going to be fun for them and all? And so I've had to sort of develop a lot more book triage than I used to, because, you know, there's a time constraint. So my rule is I read 50 pages, and if I'm just not, you know, I look up the end, because most books have a lot of middle, and sometimes the middle it's just a way to get to the end, if you see what I mean. So, you know, and you're right. I'm sure that I end up missing things. And if I weren't under the pressure of, you know, having to do this, I would probably, you know, I would delve further, but I can't do that. However, you know, readers can. So, but I still think that the author, if they can't hook you in 50 pages, is in serious danger of losing.
Yes. I mean, and sometimes I read a book and, you know, because I sometimes I think maybe I should have more confidence in my reader. You know, sometimes I kind of think, oh, I've got to get out of this situation. This is too dark, or it's too da da da, and I really just won't enjoy this. You know that bit in a horror film where it's night, 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 and then suddenly it's the daytime, and as a viewer, you're like, oh, thank goodness it's the daytime. And I always feel like I want to give readers that, where I need to turn the lights on every now and again just to give them a bit of breathing space. And sometimes I think actually I should have more confidence in readers, that actually readers can take more of something than I think they can. I think often I'll hurry it along in a way that maybe I don't need to hurry it along.
Well, I don't know, because I've certainly read books where the pace was so breathless that I was exhausted. I remember an author of a police procedural series in Los Angeles who was a serving policewoman, and her books were truly so exhausting that they didn't, you know, there were no lights on moments for the reader. So I think you're right that you need to have confidence in the reader, but also I think you have to be kind to them, to just give them, you know, like those little pauses see where we are. So we probably said there actually is a mystery in here, which is an interesting one, and it's sneaky and surprises you. Well, we aren't going to talk about that. But anyway, this is...
And also, I would say people will be reading that book for quite a long time and think, what the hell is the... What's the mystery? What are they talking about? I watched this thing. They said there'd be a mystery. It doesn't come until quite late in the book, but nearly halfway, I'd say, before you actually know that there is something to be resolved.
There is, which then explains how many of the characters behave. So there is a journey, that's for sure. So this is book number 4, and you began this career sort of midlife, as you say. I started The Poison Pen when I was 50, and we're coming up on our 34th anniversary in October. So I'm a great believer that you can reboot your life, you know, in midstream. I also married my best and last husband when I was 50, and we're coming up on our 33rd wedding anniversary. So all good things.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. All that being true, you've got years to go before you catch up with me. So what is it that you think you might be writing next, or have you already plunged into it?
I've started already, and it's kind of a different book for me. It's really the story of a life. I was reading Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, you know, Gabrielle Zevin's book. Have you read that?
Uh-huh. And I read her earlier book, the name of which is temporarily blanking out on me, which I read. Yes. Oh, it was the Storied Life of A.J. Fikre.
Okay, I haven't read that.
Well, I really enjoyed it. She's an interesting writer, it's not what you expect.
No, I mean, and that Tomorrow, I loved it. And it reminded me of how much I liked books where actually the plot is kind of the greatest plot of all. It's the story of a life. You know, yes, you know what happens in the end, but that. So the book I'm on at the moment is The Story of a Life, an Irish woman. And so the book begins when she's 10 and she's in Ireland, and then she ends up leaving Ireland and she spends time in London, she spends time in New York, and her life kind of tangentially touches kind of various kind of cultural moments along the way. So it's a very different sort of book for me, but I'm enjoying writing it so far, but let's see what happens.
So I noticed that some reviewers have compared this book anyway, or maybe I think let's just stick to this book, to that of the late lamented Maeve Binchy. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
It's a very compliment, you know, it's a very flattering comparison. It's a very nice comparison for people to make because Maeve's book did so well. I see why people do make that comparison, because they are, you know, they're not really thrillers. They're not really romances. They have kind of elements of all of those things. But they're, what they are is just stories. They're kind of stories with hopefully heart. Based in Ireland, with characters that you can kind of root for and that sort of thing. And I think that's what Maeve was brilliant at. She was so good at doing that. And I'm surprised that I've ended up, you know, because I haven't lived in Ireland since 1983. I now spend, you know, a couple of months a year there, sometimes longer. But when I started writing these books in my 50s, I don't know about you. I find reading is the most kind of intimate form of entertainment there is. You know, in that you're not watching it with anyone, you're not listening to it, you're not aware of anyone else. It's just you and those words, and you fall into those pages, and that's all you want. And often, I'm terrible at remembering authors' names. I don't know who wrote books, but I love the characters and the world. And so what I didn't want to be, because in Britain, it's different here, because here I'm not as known. But in Britain, you know, my TV show is well known and I'm on telly a lot. So I didn't want to be sort of reading over people's shoulders. I didn't want people to have my voice in their head as they were reading these books. So to try and extricate myself from the book, I got rid of anything that people might associate with me. So, you know, they're not set in the media, there's nothing to do with celebrity. In that first book, there were no gay characters. But of course, then I thought, what the hell am I going to write about? Because I'm going to write about something I know.
Where's my
And
material, right?
yeah. So it turned out the last thing I knew anything about was sort of Ireland in the 1970s. So that's where I set holding, and I was nervous making because you know Ireland and Irish readers will be very quick to tell you that you've got something wrong, or that you've remembered it incorrectly, or you've got the tone, or the people in Ireland don't speak like that. You know, have I remembered it correctly? And the biggest thrill was the success of that first book holding in Ireland. It was, you know, it was sort of number one for months and months and months, and it won awards and da da da. And that was really gratifying. I kind of, oh, I'm onto something here. So that's how I've kind of ended up setting all my books in a particular sort of Ireland, mostly in West Cork, in kind of really small rural communities.
And thus making himself an international voice
Yes.
for Harper Dina. I love it. Patrick, come and join us because you're the Irish literature and all the rest of it. And this is probably painful to you to listen to me gassing on when you could be having a real conversation.
You
sail.
know
Well,
about
I'm so impressed you've sailed around Ireland. I'm so impressed because that's not easy, but the waters are rough.
Well, I
So.
didn't. I mean, it was on an expedition ship. It was not, me in a kayak or me in a yacht. But it did allow us to get to some really interesting islands and ancient things off the West Coast. And we did go from the Scillies, which are absolutely gorgeous, all the way around, and ended up in Dublin. And then we went to Ashford Castle because naturally I can't go to Ireland without spending time
Yeah.
in Ashford Castle. And then we went back to look at Powers Court because somebody had told me how gorgeous Powers Court was. And
Beautiful.
so we were there in the in that area for a bit, and then we came home. But Patrick has been to Ireland, and I don't remember, Patrick, where you went.
Just once, but it was memorable. It was in 1999, and we were there for 3 weeks, and we kind of started in Dublin, and it was terrifying renting a car in the middle of the city, never having driven on the wrong side of the road from our perspective with the, oh man, it was, you had to learn fast. And and we kind of went all the way around the island, through Cork, and Kinsale and Clonakilty, and
Oh,
all
yeah.
down to the Kerry, the Dingle Peninsula,
Beautiful.
up through all the Clare and Doolin and all those great places. I not to blabber on about my trip, but I really fell in love with the north, with Donegal and that area up there.
I think what's interesting is it goes back to that the map thing that I think a lot of people in America look at a map of Ireland, which is so tiny. It's
Yes.
tiny. And you think 3 weeks, we've got so much time to drive around Ireland. And then you start driving around Ireland and you realize that every little bit will take a day. It's a
Right.
really it's slow going.
What was so
Very
funny
slow
is
going.
the Irish kind of their conception of distance and time, and that we would ask, okay, well, how far is it to Doolin, or whatever? Oh, it's a long way, and it's like 10 minutes up the road, So, anyway, I wanted to ask you about you mentioned Ireland in the 70s, and I was just reading about it while you were both talking. I wanted to check to see if Edna O'Brien was still alive and kicking. And I was delighted to see that she is.
Yes.
And what a masterful writer, and one that is kind of very under the radar in the United States still, even, you know, after her career.
She wrote an extraordinary book a few years ago called Girl. Did you come across it? It was about the schoolgirls who got kidnapped in Africa.
Mention of it in this article when she turned 90.
Oh yeah, because she went to Africa. Like, you kind of thought, oh, this book's going to be kind of embarrassing because it's this Irish lady in her 80s who lives in London, and she's going to be, you know, trying to write in the voice of these people, and this is not a good idea, Edna. But she went for it. She went to the country, she spent time there, and it is a stunning book. It's really worth reading. It's grueling. It's not an easy read, but it's
just
beautiful.
Called Girl, you said?
I think it's just called Girl. Yeah. Okay. And what's interesting is that it bookends her first big hit, which was The Country Girls, right. which was such a kind of cause célèbre in Ireland. It would cause such a big scandal. People were outraged that someone would kind of sort of almost like pull back the drapes and let the rest of the world see what was going on in the sort of communities that Edna had grown up in.
Liberated woman of the 60s, right?
And she was kind of showing people what it was like. And, you know, she was scandalous, but she was a very important cultural figure in Ireland. And she is part of that journey. She was probably the beginning of that journey, almost, for where Ireland is now culturally, because Ireland is now a sort of very modern, liberal, democratic place. That's happened in my lifetime. You know, I'm 60 years old, and when I see the change that's happened since I left in the 80s, it's mind-boggling to me.
Well, it's the same place. I imagine even since 1999, when I was there, it's been vastly different. You know, the whole Celtic Tiger thing happened and then kind of crashed, I guess.
Oh, yeah. If you read Jana French, you know, you can learn about that. Actually, Patrick is a big fan of Ken Bruin, who has written, you know, his crime novels have some really deep themes. He's from Galway, if I remember right. Isn't he, Patrick?
Right.
Yeah.
I like a writer named John.
At all? Graham?
Sorry?
Do you know Ken Bruin's books at all?
I don't know. Were you about to say John Banville?
No, I was about to say John McGahern or McGahern. Do you know his work?
Did he write kind of thrillers set in Northern Ireland, in Belfast?
No, they weren't really thrillers. He was more of one of those writers that defies easy classification. He wrote The Pornographers. He wrote a book called Amongst Women.
Yes. I do know him. I haven't read these books, but I do know who he is.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Let's see. Well, we do have some questions, so I don't want to hog all the airtime here. Let's see. Although I am curious about who are some of the Irish writers in particular that you really admire.
At the moment, the ones I really like, I love Donal Ryan. Do you know Donal Ryan?
Yeah. I've never read him. I've heard of him, though.
He's terrific. He's kind of, I mean, he's quite literary, but they are very readable and very engaging. If you like plot, if you like a book that you just open and get, you know, the author just grabs you by the scruff of the neck and drags you through it, try Liz Nugent. Her latest one is called
Strange Sally Diamond.
Strange Sally Diamond. I think that's my favorite. That's the favorite of her books. And talk about dark. Strange Side Diamond is a very dark book, but it's really readable. I really enjoyed it. Who else? Catherine Ryan Howard, who you mentioned earlier. Big fan of hers.
I thought 52 Days was the only pandemic book that I have read where it wasn't really about the pandemic. I thought it was a remarkable effort.
Yeah. Who else about it? Anne Enright. And who wrote the other pandemic book, which was so great? Except it wasn't about the pandemic. It came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, and it was about the Spanish flu, the Spanish flu pandemic in Dublin. She wrote Room. Emma Donoghue. I think she is terrific. And actually, she wrote her last book called Haven, is all set on a kind of fictional version of the Skellig Islands, which presumably you went to on your boat.
We did. Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, she's kind of reminds me of somebody like Edna O'Brien, you know, that it is always doing something different and never does the same thing twice, you know. Kind of an Irish Joan Didion approach.
Yeah.
Let's see here. We do have some questions. Yes, sorry, folks.
Okay.
Yeah, there are some people that are saying they'd love to read your memoirs. Have you thought about doing an autobiography?
I have. I did one when I was 40. So that was called So Me. So it'll be out there somewhere. I'm sure you can get an old used copy of it. And what I found was I really enjoyed writing it until I started working on TV. You know, in that when I got to that bit of my life, it was no longer interesting to me. And it's because I think if I do something interesting, it's on TV. People have seen it. You know, I don't get to go, you know, oh, I met George Clooney as an anecdote, because you know I met George Clooney. He was just on my show. So it's that kind of, I find the kind of tales of my life less interesting. I mean, I enjoy living my life, but writing about it becomes less interesting the more that you kind of work in an industry like television. Unless maybe when I retire from my chat show, I might kind of write a Burning All the Bridges memoir, which I might quite enjoy.
Let's see. Ginger would like to know, Graham, when do you find the time to write with your busy schedule?
I suppose what I would say for me, my writing is, it's a credible hobby is what it is. You know, I'm not like a professional writer. I don't wake up every day and you know, hit the laptop. So for me, writing is my pleasure. It's a thing I do when I have time, you know. So it's not like I have to, oh no, today I've got a stupid book, I've got to do that. It's, I look forward to it when I see space in my calendar where I can sit down and write. I want to do it. So it's, I think that's how you find time to do something. You know, if it's something you don't want to do, that's the thing that gets to the bottom of the list every single day. But for me, kind of being immersed in these worlds and just being back in Ireland in my mind, I enjoy it. So I that's how I find the time.
Or yes. If you have a contract, you're actually you're doing a paid hobby, which is.
Oh, yes. No, it is. It is. I mean, certainly that does. It keeps you interested. The people I'm amazed at, you know, I remember when I was writing my first book and I was talking to a writer and I was, you know, saying, oh, I hope it's not too bad. And they went, look, remember this. If you finish your book, it is one of the best books in the world. Because the vast majority of books aren't finished. They're on memory sticks, they're in drawers, they're in some bit of a computer somewhere. And I'm in awe of people who don't have a contract, don't have an agent, don't have anything, who are able to finish a book. Because everyone can start a book. Everyone can have that enthusiasm. And as that we were talking earlier, that excitement of, oh, wow, all these people who weren't alive a minute ago now exist, and these streets exist and all that stuff. That's really exciting. It's the heavy lifting days when you're going to give up, unless you're getting an email going, any sign of that book you told it you were writing? I think that's really the only way I got past the finishing post, was that I was contracted to write a book. So hats off to all those writers who just, you know, write a book on spec and then just, you know, keep bashing on doors till someone wants to publish it and bring it to the world.
Is there a part of the writing process that you enjoy the most? Do you like the, you know, just getting the first draft out of you? Or do you like the kind of obsessive rewriting, editing, knocking it into shape kind of part?
I mean, sometimes it is very satisfying, that kind of knocking into shape thing, because, it's such an odd job because it's an invisible job. Nobody knows how much better how much better it is than it was. So it whereas, you know, I suppose you get the whatever kudos there is for the finished book. I suppose those days, and you know, when I before I started writing novels, I used to interview novelists, a lot of novelists on my radio show. And novelists would wang on about how kind of, oh, and the character took on a life of their own, and I didn't know what they were going to do, and da, da, da. And I would just be, you know, rolling my eyes thinking, yeah, whatever. But of course, it's true. It is true. On a good day, when it's all, when the, you know, there's a fair wind, that is so exciting, where you're just writing away, and then it suddenly dawns on you, oh, I know what's going to happen in about a page and a half. I can't wait to get that. This, oh, right, they're going to do that. And, you know, those that it's not like that every day, but on the days when it is, that's when it's the most thrilling.
Let's see. Is it amazing to you sometimes when you know, you look back on what you've written in the day and you think, you know, yesterday, this character that I've just created did not exist in the world. It came fully out of my subconscious somewhere, or my imagination.
It is, and it's a kind of a blend, I think, because, you know, characters are always a kind of a some sort of mixture of people you have met, or people you sort of know, or yourself. You know, they're a kind of a little bit of all those things, if they're going to be believable or credible in any way. And it's the same with the worlds. You know, the street in the book doesn't exist, but there are streets like it, or there are elements like it. And in my head, I know, I have seen bits of those things. So it's an odd creativity, because yes, you are making it all up, but in a weird sort of way, you are channeling it from reality. It doesn't exist in this form, but it does, right. It does kind of all exist.
I see what you mean. Yeah, Cindy would like to know, would you ever consider writing a book set at Eurovision? You've been an amazing presenter, commentator for so long. I'm sure you have a ton of memories to make a great novel from real life moments.
I haven't considered it. Again, it might be one of my retirement books when I can team of
lawyers standing by.
Yeah, when I can just set fire to all the bridges and think I'm never going back to Eurovision. Here's my book. Though in fact, I that suggests I have some complaints or something about Eurovision. Eurovision Song Contest, I adore it. It's one of my favorite nights of the year. So although I'm part of it, I'm also just a huge fan of the whole thing, so delighted.
Can you give us any memorable, there are some questions that asking about some of the authors in particular that you've had on your show, any quick anecdotal stories you could tell us?
I'm trying to think. Authors, I mean, memoirists tend to be kind of the most surprising, you know. People that you don't know anything about their life. You know, there was a nun, an art loving nun in Britain called Sister Wendy Beckett. And I remember interviewing her, and she was, you know, she was like a kind of a cartoon of a nun. She was about, you know, 4 feet tall, very thin. And she, by the time I met her, she was ancient. I mean, she was really, really, really old. And she came shuffling in, and I'm not religious in any way, but that interview was sort of a religious experience. I remember she chose a bit of music, and it was some choral music. And I asked her what she chose, and she said it, and I played it. And the two of us just sat in silence and listened to that music. And it was really one of the most special moments of my life. It was really, really lovely. But then there's the kind of outre people. Did you encounter Lady Anne Glenconner when she was promoting her book Lady in Waiting? So she was Princess Margaret's Lady in Waiting. And if you have not read Lady in Waiting, her book, do yourself a favor. It is astonishing. It is the biggest roller coaster you will go on. Her life. I mean,
oh, why?
It's, I mean, you couldn't make it a movie because people would just go, what? No, none of that happened. But it is her life. And she's now, I think she just turned 90 or 91. Mm-hmm. And she is such a fabulous woman and such a great storyteller. And that book, Lady in Waiting, it has been published in America. If you haven't read it, read that book. You'll thank me.
She's a really example. If you can outlive people, it's the best revenge. It wasn't just Princess Margaret. It was her ghastly husband and all the rest of it.
I mean, oh, yes.
Funny. Yeah, you couldn't actually make it up. If you had tried to write her life as a novel, the kind of novel you're talking about, taking a woman through her life, nobody would believe it.
And then the thing with her children, where one of her sons has a terrible accident and has brain damage and nursing him back. And it is phenomenal. But, and also what's weird about it is because, you know, now that I'm 60, I can say this, she's only 90. And the beginning of the book sounds like it's set about three centuries ago. You know, it just seems the world she, as a child, the world she inhabited was medieval. It's just extraordinary. She's a real kind of connection to a bit of the past that, you know, is just turning to dust in front of her eyes.
Anything else, Patrick?
Let's see. You've touched on this a little bit, but Cindy also asks, are you a plotter or are you what they call a pantser here? Do you have an outline when you write or do you?
I do. I kind of still stick to the David Nichols thing of having an outline, but I've become much more blasé about it. I don't stick to it nearly as much as I used to. Funny enough, the book I'm writing now, The Story of a Life, I am sticking to because actually you need, because you can't do it daily. You know, you need to do it in chunks. So you know, okay, now this is going to be the chunk where this happens. This is going to be the chunk where this happens. So I'm being more disciplined this time.
And mixing up the high and the low points. I mean, it can't just be a straight line kind of a story.
Yeah, no. There's been quite a lot of low so far, but I'm only 20,000 words in. So she's on the way up. Very soon, there'll be some, I'll turn the lights on very soon.
That'd be great. Plus, you can always revise, you know, as you pointed out, nobody sees the book until you're saying that it's done.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Somebody was asking who was the author you just mentioned, and it was Lady Anne Glenconner, correct?
Yeah, Lady Anne Glenconner, and the book is called Lady in Waiting. And
Lady in Waiting, but then I think some publishers had her actually write a mystery or two, or possibly not her, but in her name.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of that going on, yeah.
Yes, well, there is a fair amount of that, you know, where publishers like to, we've had that happen. We had Betty Ford briefly had a mystery series, the, you know, wife of President Ford, and the author came to the store, clearly wasn't Betty Ford, you know. So, I'm okay with it if they're straightforward, you know, but what I really hate is when publishers pretend that Martina Navratilova actually wrote the three mysteries that were published.
Hillary Clinton wrote a book with someone.
Well, she wrote it with Louise Penny. So
yes,
she provided context, and Louise did the writing in the same way that Bill Clinton wrote a book with two, actually, Jim Patterson. I Lee Child and I actually did the launch for the Bill Clinton, Jim Patterson book. And it was wonderful. President Clinton, I have to tell you, can talk. and so Lee and I, and actually Jim Patterson, we all just kind of sat there and let him run. And it was wonderful. But he did contribute, you know, the background, the knowledge, you know, the sort of Patrick O'Brien stuff, except Patrick O'Brien then actually wrote the books.
Yeah, no, I interviewed Hillary Clinton about it, and she was very open about the fact she did not, you know, it wasn't like they were swapping chapters. It was just, you know, Hillary would read it and then have her notes and her comments and so, but you know, she was there, which is, I think, fair enough.
Sure. I think if you have somebody that has special knowledge, you know, particular expertise, that if they can hook up with a writer who, you know, can tell the story, that it makes perfectly good sense. Do you remember Robert Harris wrote a book called The Ghostwriter that was just an amazing example of how that profession works? But a ghostwriter is different because the ghostwriter is supposed to be anonymous. That wonderful author, Michael Robotham, who lives in Australia, and I've been lucky enough to debut several of his books in the last while. He still writes books more or less set in England, but he wrote something like he did ghostwriting professionally for like 15 years before he wrote his first novel. And that's where he learned to be a novelist, you know, is ghostwriting. So amazing stuff.
It's such a strange job, such a strange job.
It really is. You know what? I warned you all at the beginning that digression was what we do. And I think we've now digressed to the point where we probably ought to stop. Unless there's some sort of question that we've missed, because we actually went for an hour and we were only supposed to do this for 30 minutes. So,
oh, well, all good. All good. It's been lovely talking to you.
We've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Let's say, let's give Robin, who's watching, the last word. She says, outliving people is the best revenge.
Yeah. Outliving people well is the best revenge. Yes.
Exactly. So thank you very much, everyone, for watching our program. Thank you, Graham, for spending time with us. Let me remind you again, this is Graham Norton, Forever Home, which will be on your bookstore shelves very shortly. And you'll really enjoy it. So thank you so much, everyone. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.